This free program is paid for by the listener sponsors of WORT Community Radio in Madison, Wisconsin. If you haven't already, please consider donating online to help keep Radio of the Free alive.
Welcome to another edition of Third World View, your weekly source for news and analysis from around the third world, right here on community-supported radio, WORT 89.9.
Welcome to the January 17th edition of Third World View. I'm your host, Steve. For our feature tonight, we are going to be listening to a interview with Haiti filmmaker and journalist Kevin Pena. This was recorded earlier this year by Third World View Collective member Mark Becker and was recorded prior to the earthquake last Tuesday.
Good evening. This is Mark Becker, a member of the Third World View Collective. I am here in Haiti the first week of January on a delegation, and I'm very privileged to be tonight with Kevin Pena, who's a filmmaker, a journalist, a special correspondent for Flashpoints on Pacifica on Haiti News. He's been covering Haiti since 1991. He lived in Haiti from 1999 to 2006. He's a documentary filmmaker who's made films such as Haiti, We Must Kill the Bandits. And thank you for joining us tonight, Kevin.
My pleasure, Mark.
I think before we want to talk largely about current politics and what's happening in the country and where things are going. But if you could explain to our listeners, just give a brief overview, Haiti's history, where it comes from, why is it unique in the Americas? Just a little bit of its colonial and modern history.
Well, it's one of the first places that Christopher Columbus landed, end of 1492. I think it was the second place after the Bahamas. And when he landed here, there were approximately 1 million indigenous people, the Arawaks and the Tainos. Within a period of 15 years, they had reduced that population to 60,000. That means that approximately 940,000 people, indigenous people, were massacred, killed from disease, ill treatment from the Spanish conquistadors. And it's, of course, after the Arawaks and Tainos were decimated that we now have Bartholomew de las Casas, who's known as the great Catholic saint, patron saint of the indigenous peoples of the Americas, who then feels sorry for the remaining 60,000 and suggests to Charles V of Spain that they import African slaves to replace them in order to save them. If you can imagine a saint being canonized for ushering in the evil of slavery into the new world.
I think there's deep levels of irony, isn't there, that dating back to the beginning of the role of the Catholic Church and of different colonial powers and how they formed the history of this island, no?
And there's great ironies as far as the powers that tried to control it. Of course, the Spanish controlled it until 1647 when under the Treaty of Ryswick. They then had to turn it over to France, and it became the wealthiest colony in the world. Sugar plantations, primarily sugar, rum, there was gold, and the French made tremendous profit off of it. But of course, all of it being done on the backs of slaves and with slavery being imposed brutally in this colony. If you look back historically, the French were among the most brutal of the slave colonists in the New World. Just horrible, horrible examples of exemplary death by torture. All of this, of course, meant to intimidate the population of the slaves, because remember, you had 50,000 whites controlling nearly 500,000 slaves.
Do you think this history would have been different had the island stayed in the hands of the Spanish instead of moving over to the French?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that the Spanish were Of course, they were brutal in terms of slaughtering populations that they found that were existing. But when it came to after there were no more new territories to seize in the area from native peoples, the French colonists developed a reputation as among the most brutal of the slave owners in the hemisphere. Of course, during the same period, we know that our own country, our own government, its own economic development was also intricately intertwined with human chattel, a continuing trade in human chattel. What happened also is one of the ways that the French slave owners controlled those populations is most of them came from Western Africa in an area that we now know as Benin. And they would separate families. They would separate people who spoke the same languages. They would separate people who came from the same villages. Anything that gave them cultural cohesion, they would try to destroy because, again, it was a small population of slave owners controlling this much larger population of slaves. So they didn't want them to have anything culturally to rally around. But the one thing that the slaves had in common that the French slave masters didn't count upon was Dahomey, which was the African religion that would later develop into what we now know as modern voodoo in Haitian society. And that's why it's no accident that in 1791, in the forest of Bois Caïman, a voodoo priest named Bookman held a voodoo ceremony that ushered in the 13-year war for independence, which would ultimately lead to Haiti defeating the armies of Napoleon, the Spanish, and the British, including Napoleon's brother-in-law Leclerc, to become the world's first black republic, and I dare say the world's only successful revolution, if you define revolution as a complete overturning of the previous order.
And it really puts Haiti on a unique course in terms of the Americas, in terms of the direction that the American republics go, no?
No question. And it certainly brought Haiti the ire of the world. The U.S. and France led an economic boycott of Haiti that lasted nearly 100 years.
And arguably, Haiti's never recovered from that boycott.
Oh, absolutely. It was devastated not only by that, but also, if you can imagine, years later, the Haitian government was forced to actually pay restitution to the former slave owners so that France would recognize its independence. But more importantly, the role that Haiti played as far as U.S. foreign policy was that it inspired slave revolutions in our country. Denmark Vesey, Nat Turner, John Brown, Gabriel Prosser, all of them spoke of emulating the example of Haiti. And so it's no accident that the U.S. Senate of 1806 declared Haiti the greatest threat to U.S. interests at home and abroad in the world.
In retrospect, do you think there is something that the Haitian government could have done differently after independence in 1804 that it goes from being the most wealthy colony today to being the poorest country in the Americas? Any reflections on what could have been done differently to avoid that fate?
I mean, there was always a struggle between whether or not. Remember, they always were consistently being attacked by the French for many years afterwards, where they were trying to reclaim the island, where they were trying to reimpose slavery. So it was constantly a government that was embattled, a government that could never really establish any sort of stability. And again, there was this economic isolation and boycott almost immediately following its independence, led by the U.S. and France, that made it impossible for, it made it even more impossible for stability to take hold. And then, of course, there was the assassination of one of the great leaders of the revolution, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, and that was really over land reform. Jean-Jacques Dessalines wanted to divide the land among the black slaves so that everyone would have something to work on, and he was killed for that, basically by those who wanted to maintain a centralized authority and to maintain the same sort of plantation system that the French had maintained, but over time that couldn't be sustained, and it led to even more instability in the country, and there became infighting. And then, of course, there was a period where there was the mulatto class that had come into power. There were the wars with Petion between his army Henri Christophe, where the country was actually divided between a mulatto-led general who was a descendant of a slave woman who had laid with a French slave master, and those slaves who were just pure African slaves. And that dichotomy, of course, would later affect Haitian politics for many, many years to come, and those class differences, because, of course, the mulatto class ultimately would be able to go to France and to study at the Sorbonne, many of them. They would become the administrative class of Haiti, whereas the only way for blacks, those who were of more pure African blood, to gain any sort of social status was through the military.
Some people have said that Haiti, throughout its more than 200 years of history, has always been plagued by authoritarian leadership, political leadership. What is your view on that?
Well, I don't know any country in its early years that isn't plagued by authoritarian leadership. There are a great many countries that we can point to today that arguably are still under the grip of authoritarian leadership. I don't know that Haiti is necessarily any great exception as far as world development and the way in which cultures and societies and administrative authority develop. Haiti does have its own particular history. As I said, there was always this tension between the class of those who were lighter skinned and those who were darker skinned. And unfortunately, what happened is that because Haiti could never really gain any sort of stability, again, because of the economic boycott, because of foreign interference in Haitian affairs, largely, there was always this tendency for leaders to come into office, take what they could, seize what they could, knowing that at some point they were then going to be overthrown by another successive dictator, or another successive authoritarian figure. And so it was this pattern that was established over time historically in this country. But you've also got to remember that, again, you can't discount the effect of the embargo, and you can't discount the effect of foreign countries that interfered in Haiti's internal politics. I'll give you an example. Haiti's first ambassador from the United States, because Haiti was not recognized officially by the United States until the administration of Abraham Lincoln, many, many years later. And
1862,
that's right. And Frederick Douglass, who was, of course, a black man, an abolitionist, became the first ambassador to Haiti. Well, Frederick Douglass resigned, and in his resignation speech, you will see that he says the reason that he resigned is because of greedy businessmen and bankers who were manipulating Haitian politics in order to put greater profits in their pockets. And he points to that specifically as the reason behind his resignation. And I think, and he talked about it being part of the history of the relationship between the United States, and that he didn't feel that he was in any position to change it, and as a result, he resigned.
We're speaking here tonight with filmmaker-journalist Kevin Pina on Third World View about the history and current situation in Haiti. I want to skip way ahead to Aristide. Could you explain a little bit who was Aristide, why he emerges when he does, a little bit of the significance of him?
Well, Aristide really comes out of what was called the Little Church Movement, which was a division between the hierarchy of the Catholic Church and what were called Christian-based communities.
He's a priest, right?
Yes, he's a Catholic priest, former Catholic priest, but he comes out of this experience of liberation theology in Latin America. There are these Jesuit Belgian priests who had come to Haiti, and they had begun Haiti's first literacy program in the 60s. It was called Mission Alpha, or Mission Literacy, and they chose as their first literacy book, they named it Goutte Sel, or A Taste of Salt, which, according to the voodoo legend, in order for a zombie to turn against his master and regain his humanity, you give him a taste of salt on his tongue. But the symbolism wasn't lost on Duvalier, because what they were really saying to the peasants were, if you learn to read and write, you have the right to turn against a dictator and gain your own freedom. So they actually kicked the Catholic Church, Duvalier, actually kicked the Catholic Church out of Haiti and forbid Catholic Mass. And as a response, the Vatican was forced to sit down and negotiate with him, and Duvalier was the only head of state in history ever allowed to appoint his own bishops by the Catholic Church. So the hierarchy of the Catholic Church became part and parcel of the corrupt system of the Duvalier legacy. At the same time, the students of these Belgian priests, such as Father Antoine Adrien, Father Jean-Marie Vincent, and the young priest Father Jean-Bertrand Aristide, were part of what were called the Christian-based communities, or the Little Church. And they were espousing that to walk in the footsteps of Jesus meant to work on behalf of the poor, that whereas a wealthy man might be concerned with going to heaven, a poor man was necessarily concerned with feeding himself and his family, and that you couldn't save a person's soul if they were suffering in misery, that you had to tend to their mortal needs in real time. And if that meant getting involved in politics and changing structures of social injustice, then that's what the gospel dictated. That was their interpretation of the gospel. And Father Jean-Bertrand Aristide was catapulted into the presidency by this movement of the Christian-based communities called Tille Église, that then also built coalition with other sort of central social democratic parties called the FNCD. And December 16, 1990, he won by the highest plurality of any elected head of state in the history of the hemisphere, 67% of the vote.
Briefly, what were the issues involved at that point in terms of a Catholic priest entering electoral politics? We've seen other examples more recently with Lugo in Paraguay, and this is always a controversial issue. Could you remind us a little bit of what issues in 1990 were involved in that decision?
Well, you know, we got to go back a little bit to the 80s because it was in the early 90s, but mid 80s, the Vatican and the hierarchy of the Catholic Church tried to transfer Aristide out of his parish. Remember, in 1988, in Saint Jean Bosco, his parish here, they were attacked on September the 11th, 1988, where the parish was burned to the ground. 12 parishioners were killed. A pregnant woman lost her unborn child, or her fetus was killed in her stomach. It was a horrible, horrible affair. It was the Duvalier mayor of Port-au-Prince at that time, Franck Womain, who had launched that attack along with General Namphy, those who were involved in the military dictatorship that was ruling Haiti after the fall and the fleeing of baby Doc Duvalier. And it was shortly thereafterwards that the Catholic Church said, well, you're too involved in politics, and tried to transfer him away from his parish in Port-au-Prince. And there were tens and tens of thousands of people in the streets protested that they actually burned the National Cathedral to the ground. Some say that they kidnapped, but what they did was they grabbed the papal nuncio and took him from his residence and ran him through the streets without his clothes as a way of humiliating him and giving a clear message to the hierarchy of the Catholic Church and the Vatican that Aristide was not to be touched. And it was shortly thereafter that he was reassigned back to Port-au-Prince. But in the meantime, of course, the U.S. press, the U.S. government, what was then considered, we didn't have the word international community then, but what was then the world powers such as France, Canada, and the United States who were involved in Haiti. Of course, the propaganda was that he was an ultra-leftist priest, that he was unstable, that he was preaching class warfare. These were regular themes, of course, that were brought up against other liberation theology priests throughout Latin America. But in the Haitian experience, it was quite clear that the masses were endeared to him, and that they saw him as one of their own, and that he had managed to capture their imagination that they had a right to participate in the politics of their own the politics of their own country, that it had a right to participate in their own affairs and to represent their own interests for the first time in history.
One question that some of us solidarity activists have had about Hugo Chavez in Venezuela is whether he's the real thing or whether he's just another populist who's going to use the people to get in power and then sell our interests out later. And so my question is Aristide the real thing? Is he really committed to the people, or is he just another populist opportunist who talks his talk in order to advance his own political interests?
Well, I mean, I think I'd have to be clear about what the definition of, when you say another populist opportunist, who you're referring to, but...
Well, let's talk, I don't know, Obama.
Okay, well, that's a good... Now I have a reference point to begin here. For myself, and I can only speak of my own experience.
Let me just contextualize that. We've had people here in Haiti who've said that they thought Obama was a new Aristide and are disappointed that his policies haven't followed through with his campaign rhetoric. And that's my question about Aristide. There's always these politicians who have good campaign rhetoric but never follow through with their promises.
Well, I think if he hadn't followed through with his promises, he'd probably still be in Haiti today. And that the biggest proof that he remained a threat to Canada, France, and the United States primarily, who seem to be the major adversaries of the Haitian people and this popular movement for change, that if he had not remained adversarial to them, that he'd still be in this country today. I think that he tried to play the game. The Haitian people have tried to play the democratic game by the rules that have been prescribed to them by the international community, primarily our government, the United States government. Again, the elections in 1990, where Aristide won by that huge majority, 67%, only to see that overthrown by a military coup 6.5 months later on September 30th, 1991, a coup that was clearly supported by the first Bush the Senior's administration. And then, of course, we saw him reelected in 2000. He assumed the office in February 7, 2001, and we saw him overthrown again in 2004 before he could complete. He's never completed a single term in this country, never been allowed to complete a single term. And I think that in itself speaks volumes. But did he at many times try to play the game in order to buy time for the movement, in order to assuage some of his adversaries internationally? Yeah, I think he did. I think that he at certain times felt that he didn't have a choice. I'll give you an example. When the height of the killing after the coup of 1991, let's say in 1994, at the height of the killing, when the Haitian military and the paramilitary death squad front, the Front for Advancement and Progress in Haiti, were slaughtering people in the streets, he was told nearly point blank by the Clinton administration, look, you're either going to sign off on these IMF accords, you're either going to sign off on the World Bank agreements, or the killing's going to continue. I mean, he's basically said as much to me that that's how he felt. He felt as if he and the Haitian people had a gun to their heads if they did not agree to these concessions. Now, when he returned in 1994, of course, what we saw was something quite different. Although that they had signed those agreements, as he and many understand, under duress, the popular movement, the base, would not allow them to go through. They would not allow for privatization. They would not allow for foreign factories to come in and provide, you know, low-paying wage jobs is what we're seeing today in Haiti. There was this real fight against what they called Plan L'Amour, or the neoliberal economic model, because they were very, very clear about it. Remember that it had been tried before under the Caribbean Basin Initiative under Ronald Reagan in the 80s, where they said that Haiti's comparative advantage was its cheap labor.
What is the relationship between Aristide as a charismatic leader and the social movement base? There's a common demand here in Haiti now among his supporter in Lavalas for his return. How important is that versus social movement organizing to realize some of these changes?
Well, I mean, it's a hard question. I mean, it's really, I can only give an opinion, my own opinion and analysis on it. I think that Aristide has said many times, and you should read his book Dignity, where he actually says that what he believes is that it's not his position to appoint leadership within the Lavalas, the Famille Lavalas party, the Famille Lavalas movement, but that leadership within the popular movement, based upon its own historical trajectory, must grow organically from their own experience. He has resisted many times to appoint people as leaderships or representatives. At the same time, he himself has offered himself up as a symbol. He's clearly become a symbol of that movement and what it represents. I don't think that he, I think that when people talk about Aristide as a charismatic leader, when you hear Haitians talk about it, that's really what they're talking about. It's not Aristide the man, but Aristide the symbol. They know that one man can never change things for them. They know that it's really they themselves who have to do it. But Aristide represents to them the best chance that they ever had at doing that. He represented the largest victories they've ever succeeded against tremendous opposition. Because remember, it's not just the opposition of the U.S. Embassy and the French Embassy and the Canadian Embassy that they've had to face here. They've also had to face the 1% of the population who controls over 50% of the collective wealth of this country, a very vociferous elite, which has shown itself historically that when it cannot succeed with using corruption in order to maintain power within the state, that it will readily turn to violence. Historically,
Haiti has midterm congressional elections on February 28th. Could you explain a little bit of the issues and dynamics around those upcoming elections?
Well, the largest political party, the Famille Lavalas party, Jean-Bertrand Aristide's party, was banned from the last parliamentary elections, which were held last April and June in two rounds of elections. And they called for a boycott because they were basically excluded on a technicality, not allowed to run. On the other hand, we say that they're excluded on a technicality because remember that this Provisional Election Council is hand-picked by President Preval, who seems to clearly now be working along with U.S. foreign policy makers as well as the international community when it comes to a solution for what they call development in Haiti. We've seen now again that Lavalas has been excluded a second time from these upcoming February elections. Clearly, if you take a sampling of the voices of the base, the people in the street, all of them will say two things really clearly. One, they want Aristide to return. Two, that you cannot have elections without Lavalas. And that's where we are with this right now. Although, we also have to say it's a very complicated, difficult period. It's probably the most difficult period that I've ever experienced among the movement of the poor here in this country. We see that President Preval has literally had billions of dollars at his disposal, or we could say hundreds of millions, but if we include, of course, UN troops factored into that, we can say billions, because certainly they've been working to support and keep his government in office. But we also know that he's created a system of political patronage where we have examples. We've been told numerous times that he's actually spread money in the streets. He's actually bought political leaders who were formerly Lavalas to bring them into his camp, all of this in an apparent strategy to divide and break up the Famille Lavalas party. It's an extension of what happened from the coup of 2004. That was an attempt to violently destroy that movement, and now this is the next phase where apparently Preval is now using the money of the international community in the next phase of the operation to destabilize and destroy that people's movement. And this next phase means keeping Lavalas out of the elections because they know that if the Famille Lavalas party were allowed to run, that the majority of the people would elect them. And that's the last thing in the world they want. Because what does it say about the international community's justification for ousting Aristide in 2004? They said that it was necessary because he had become a dictator and the Lavalas party had turned into a violent political movement. Well, if Lavalas were to enter free and democratic elections and win, that would, of course, give truth to their two big lies that justified ousting a democratically elected leader in this country.
Okay, we have just a minute remaining. Could you briefly summarize what you see as the future of Haiti, specifically of social movements? Where do you see this country going, and maybe where would you like to see it going?
One thing I have to say about the Haitian people is, in addition to their resiliency, they are also, it's very hard to know when the surprise is going to happen, but these people en masse will hit the streets at any moment when their interests coalesce around a specific issue or a specific moment in history. I think that we're going to see a lot of surprises and shocks for the international community to come. These people have been brutalized. Now these people are being humiliated. They're being told that what's going to help them are jobs that pay about $3 a day, where we're only going to see 50,000 of those created over the next 10 years, but they're faced with 80% unemployment. They're being humiliated because they still, after all of the billions of dollars of investment by the international community, there are still no basic fundamental social services. The general hospital cannot accommodate the number of people who are ill in the capital. Of course, there are 2 million people, more than 2 million people now in this capital. The roads are still not paved. The capital itself does not have more than 5 hours of electricity a night. This simply is nothing to show for all that money. And for them, it's a humiliating experience.
Thanks, Kevin. This is fascinating and helps us understand the background. We'll keep watching here on Third World View what's happening in Haiti as these elections approach and as we go in the future. We've been speaking with Kevin Pina, a filmmaker, journalist, special correspondent for Long History here in Haiti. Thanks for joining us tonight, Kevin.
My pleasure, Mark.
For Third World View, this is Mark Becker.
You can hear more about Mark and Haiti in the coming weeks as he will bring us some additional reports. You can also visit his website at wachana.org. That's wachana.org. And if you look to the bottom of his website, you'll see a link to information on Haiti. And real quickly here, before we call it a day, coming up next Saturday is the Freeze for Food Run as part of the returning Peace Corps volunteers. You can visit their website at rpcvmadison.org to learn more. We are all out of time here on Third World View. Please stay tuned for Salamat, which is coming up next. And please join us again next week here on Third World View.
Third World View is written and produced by a collective of volunteers. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can also contact us at the station if you're interested in joining our collective and helping to bring third world issues to the airwaves. Third World View can be heard every Sunday from 5 to 6 p.m. right here on WORT, your community radio.
Thank you for listening to this free program provided by WORT Community Radio in Madison, Wisconsin. Become a listener sponsor. Donate to WORT online at WORTFM.org or call 608-256-2001 during business hours.